This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living with me, Tisha Oik. It's our Ask a Doctor segment today. That's our open clinic show. And for today's show, I have Dr. Shilpa Nambia, consultant obstetrician and gynecologist, joining me to discuss and to answer all your questions about labor and childbirth. I guess if you're a woman who is expecting right now, or if you have been through pregnancy before, this is such a big part of that conversation. What to expect? Are you prepared for it? So do ask us all your questions. Can be anything from what do contractions feel like to whether cesarean sections are really the way to go, or should it be natural? If you want to know about your birthing options, anything, there's so much information out there, which can also mean that there's a lot of confusion. So Dr. Shilpa is here to answer your questions. You can call us at 03-7733-2900. You can also WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Dr. Shilpa, how are you?
Hello, Shawik. Thank you very much for inviting me here today. It's a pleasure to be with you again. And as an obstetrician, I feel like I'm very fortunate because unlike other doctors who see people who are sick, I get to share a very special experience of pregnancy with women. And then I'm always there at a very big milestone of their life, which is welcoming a new member into their family. And, you know, as we were chatting earlier, I realized that no matter how far away it was and when the last experience was of delivery, This is something a woman remembers in such great detail that I think it's important to try and make that experience as pleasant as possible.
Absolutely. And I do hope that it will be pleasant, barring, of course, you know, there may be some medical issues that some women go through. But at the end of the day, you're welcoming a life, a baby.
Exactly.
And, you know, like I said, the what I brought up about confusion and information or misinformation, I kind of experienced that myself. You know, there's so much to read, so many people telling you things, and you end up feeling inundated and you don't know how to make the decision that is best for yourself and your baby, I think.
That's right.
Yeah. So I hope that for all of you listening, do take this chance to kind of try and get some clarity if you haven't already from your physician. Again, the number to call, 03-7733-2900. You can also WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Perhaps we will try to be a little bit chronological about this while we're waiting for the questions to come in, Dr. Shilpa. Before we talk about going into labor, a woman in that last trimester, what changes is she going through? How is she feeling at that time?
Okay, I think we should start a little bit before that. And let's just start from where the pregnancy starts, when the pregnancy test is positive, right? And you'll find that most people talk about pregnancy as a 9-month period. But really, in medical terms, we look at it in terms of weeks. So, and we normally count the weeks from the last menstrual period, because what we're assuming is that 2 weeks after that last period is when you ovulated and when you conceived this child. So an expected delivery date, the EDD that a doctor will give you, is 40 weeks from that last menstrual period. Mm-hmm. And the pregnancy itself is divided into 3 trimesters, the first 12 weeks, 12 to 24, and then 24 until you pop. Now, up to 37 weeks, the baby is still developing, still maturing. All the organs are still learning to do what it's supposed to do. But after 37 weeks, this is what we consider term. This is when women can go into labor at any time, and the baby will most likely be well enough to survive outside. But the period of 37 to 42, mm-hmm. which is what we consider full term, is also divided into different whether it's an early term, late term, or post term. Mm. And why this is important is because obviously if you go into labor and everything is fine, it's great. But we also know that this is a time when the placenta doesn't work as well as it might have been in the earlier part of pregnancy. So the baby might be getting a little bit compromised, a little bit stressed, and to leave the baby in for even longer than 41 or 42 weeks may be dangerous, and the risk of stillbirth goes up. So that date really is something that we have to start considering an induction of labor if it hasn't already happened naturally.
Okay. Induction of labor, you'd start looking at it at 41?
Well, it depends from woman to woman, her risk factors, how old she is when she got pregnant. 40 weeks is the due date. Mm. And for most healthy women whose pregnancies have gone without any complications, it is probably okay to give it another week or so if the intention is to labor naturally. But by this time, your body has already started making some preparations for labor. And in fact, if you find that actually the baby's growth is starting to slow down, the movements are less and less, it may be a sign that baby needs to come out before your body says it is. And so then an induction is just helping it along a little bit earlier. There is nowhere in the world that will allow you to go past 42 weeks because then the stillbirth rate just triples.
And you can tell if the baby is doing okay. You mentioned things like, you know, if the growth is slowing down, whether the baby might be feeling stressed. You can tell all of that?
There are some objective ways of measuring these things. And one of the most valuable things actually is the mother's perception of baby's movements. And this is really important. Some people don't think it's important enough to notice. But a baby already has his sleep-wake pattern, times that he sleeps, times that he plays. And this is very apparent from early pregnancy. And that pattern continues right until after delivery. So if you find that, okay, normally my baby's really active at 5 o'clock and at 11 o'clock at night, and today it's a bit quiet. So the first thing you try and do is maybe drink some cold water, change your position, because then you also force the baby to change position. And if the movements then continue, then there's no problem. Maybe prod a bit, talk to him. But if the baby's still not moving that much, then it's time to go to the hospital. Because sometimes what happens is that as the placenta gets mature and ages, it doesn't transfer as much oxygen to the baby. So if you've been getting 5 meals a day and suddenly you're only getting 3, you're going to say, okay, I'm going to skip playtime. And that's one of the first things a woman will experience, reduced movements. And it is important. But from an objective point of view, we can do an ultrasound. We can measure the fluid around the baby. We can actually see what the baby's heart rate is. We can even measure baby's heart rate for a period of 20 to 30 minutes, see what he's doing in there. And that can give us a better idea of how he is.
But can trust the mother's instincts and feelings, right?
I think it's important to trust the mother's instincts and feelings, because sometimes despite everything looking really good, if the mother feels something is wrong, I need to pay attention.
Absolutely. We already have a question from Zach, who's asking on behalf of his wife, how soon can we observe the baby and heartbeat using abdomen ultrasound? My wife has a retroverted uterus. We went for an ultrasound yesterday, week 6, day 6. We can only observe
gestational sac, not yolk and embryo. Is this normal? All right. So when you say 6 weeks and 6 days, this means you're counting from the last menstrual period. That doesn't mean that the baby is 6 weeks old. It means actually the baby is probably only 4 weeks old if your wife has a regular 28 to 30 day cycle. What happens is that some women have a longer cycle, 35 days, for example. This just means that she probably ovulated later, got pregnant later, and this means that the baby may not be 4 weeks. It may only be 2 or 3 weeks. That doesn't mean that this baby is abnormal. It just means that you might have wrong dates. And you just have to give it some time to see whether this baby continues developing normally. Or it could be the reverse, which is the dates are correct. You are exactly 6 weeks. And if you don't see what should be seen by that time, which is a little fetal echo with a heartbeat, then there is a chance that this could end up as a miscarriage. But it's important not to assign one or the other so soon, and to give it some time to see whether it will get bigger?
Because we're talking about quite a major difference between, say, 2 to 3 weeks and 6 weeks, right?
Yes.
We're talking about a baby, an embryo, a fetus, still being very, very, very...
very small.
Small,
yes.
Very small at that point. So we talked about the time the baby is conceived. We talked about what is term, what's full term, early, late, how we want to look at the risks if a woman goes past 40 weeks. Are you ready to talk about labor yet?
Oh, yes. This is what everyone's been waiting for.
Yeah. You know, I guess, you know, assuming, I mean, if we want to talk about under typical circumstances, assuming a woman is ready to go into labor at, you know, close to 40 weeks or whenever she's reached term, what's happening there in her body?
Okay. So from 37 weeks, as I said before, the baby is mature. But when labor starts, what triggers it, whether it's something from the mother, something from the baby, this is something we don't completely understand. What we do know is that women tend to behave the same with every pregnancy. So even her previous pregnancy, she went into labor at 37, most likely that's what's going to happen this time as well. Mm-hmm. And in the previous pregnancy, if she went into labor at 41, this is what's going to happen in this pregnancy as well. But if it's your first pregnancy, then you have no idea. But what can start happening even 1 or 2 weeks before active labor is initiated is that you'll start to feel more pressure. The head should hopefully have come down and stayed in the pelvis by then. And then you'll feel a lot more pressure as the head descends and engages into the pelvic bones. You might start to feel some low back ache. You can't get rid of it. And this may be related to what's going on in the cervix. Now, the cervix is the mouth of the uterus. This looks a little bit like a funnel, if you imagine. That's the skinny part of the funnel. And the top part is where the uterus and where the baby's head is. Now, at the start of labor, before anything has been initiated, you'll find that the cervix is quite long, 3, maybe even 4 centimeters long, and it's completely closed. But as the cervix gets primed, it starts thinning out. So the funnel gets thinner, smaller and smaller, and the cervix starts to dilate, which is opening up to let the baby come through. Mm. That part of effacement of the cervix, the thinning out of the cervix, can sometimes take weeks.
Mm.
So this whole process where the cervix hasn't thinned out, hasn't started dilating, until the time a woman gets to 4, 5, 6 centimeters is something called a latent phase of labor. There used to be a time we thought that if they took too long with the latent phase of labor, we needed to do something about it. But now we know it can even take a week. So as long as baby and mum are okay, it's important to just leave women to be. Because if it will happen, you will see that there's progressive change in the cervix. Then the head starts to slowly continue to come down. And once you go into active labor, that's 6 centimeters and above, and contractions are coming, let's say, every 2 to 3 minutes, then it goes really quickly. Because by this time, the cervix from previously being maybe 3 or 4 centimeters is now paper thin.
Mm.
So it dilates very fast. So some women will find that they go from 6 to 10 in an hour.
Oh, okay.
And for some women, it takes a little bit longer. So it's important to also say there's not a prescriptive time that you must deliver within this time. It's just important to see that there is gradual change and progress towards a delivery.
Mm. And the gynae will be basically monitoring that. You'll be able to measure the dilation. And I come back to trust the woman and what she's going through, right?
Yes. So if a woman's coming to you, you know, towards the later part of the pregnancy saying, oh, you know, I'm feeling a lot more pressure. It's getting difficult to walk because I feel, and some women describe something called lightning crotch, where there's like a electricity going through the vagina. And that's, you know, just because of positioning of the baby as it irritates certain nerves in that area. It might be, and especially if you also do an ultrasound and find the head is really low, it might be important to just do a digital examination, which means introducing a finger into the vagina just to see whether the cervix is starting to change. Because although it's not common, I have had women who had no symptoms at all. And then when you examine them, they're already 6 centimeters dilated.
Mm.
And that's a nice thing to be because you haven't felt most of your labor. But for a majority, once it starts, you will start to feel something.
All right. We'll come back and continue this conversation. What happens after 6 centimetres? And perhaps the part that most women dread, do we really need to be dreading it? The actual process of delivery. I'm speaking to consultant obstetrician and gynecologist Dr. Shilpa Nambia about labour and childbirth. Send in or call in with your questions because this is the Open Clinic Show. You can call 03-7733-2900. You can also WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll be right back on Health and Living BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Shao-Ik, and my guest, consultant obstetrician and gynecologist, Dr. Shilpa Nambia. It's our Ask a Doctor segment, and that's our open clinic show where you can ask our doctor in the house any questions that you have. Today is about labour and childbirth. So do send in your questions. If WhatsApp is preferred, 018-789-8899 is the number to send it to. If you'd like to call, 03-7733-2900, or you can WhatsApp us. You can tweet us at BFM Radio. Ask on behalf of your spouse as well, as we had with Zach earlier in the show. So, Dr. Shilpa, you said that active labour is when the cervix is dilated at 6 centimetres and above. So what happens after that?
All right. So even at the start of labour, if you're only 2 or 3 centimetres, the contractions have already started. It may be far in between, maybe 10, 15 minutes once. And contractions really start at maybe, let's give it some arbitrary numbers, at 1 and go right up to 10 before you deliver. So it gets progressively more intense, more frequent, more difficult maybe to manage. But pain is very subjective and it's a different experience from women to women. So all you need to know is that it is going to get progressively worse. If this is something that you can cope with, either just by changing your position, doing breathing exercises, some women do some hypnobirthing, massage, sitting in the tub, if all of this helps you, then great. But if it gets to a point where you're starting to need some help, then, you know, that's when you come to the hospital and the doctor can help you with different types of pain relief options. Mm. But I think it's important not to feel as if you have to go a certain way, because it's very hard to predict how you will respond to pain if you've never experienced it before. And if you need help, there's no issue in asking for it.
But that's such a big debate, isn't it? Mm. A lot of women are told you shouldn't have epidurals because... there's a long list of beliefs or whatever you want to call it. It will harm you down the line. It will harm your baby. Can you address some of the things that you've heard from your patients, and how would you rationalize that?
Okay, the commonest thing I hear about epidurals is that it's going to cause long-term back issues and back pain. Now, that is a complete myth. What is going to cause the back pain after the delivery is the pregnancy itself. Because for 7 months of that
exactly.
9, you're in a very exaggerated position and suddenly that posture changes and that's going to cause some pain. Whether you had an epidural or not makes no difference in that. But what an epidural is, it sounds quite scary because it's a needle that is introduced in your back and it goes very close to where the spine is. And the doctor introduces a little bit of local anesthetic so that all the nerves that are coming out of there are sort of bathed in this local anesthetic and the pain is completely blocked. So some women feel that if they don't feel pain, the progress of labor will be reduced or it'll become longer. But that's not true. The pain continues. The contractions continue. It's just that you don't feel it as much. And in fact, the epidural can reduce about 90% of the pain. What the epidural will not do is that it will not stop you feeling pressure. So when the baby is still quite high up, hasn't gone right down to the entrance of the vagina, you may not feel it. But when the baby's head is very low down, it starts to press against all the structures around it, your bladder, especially the bowel. And so what you will get is a sensation that you need to empty your bowel and you need to do a big poo. Mm. So that pressure, the epidural cannot take away. Mm. And that pressure is what is teaching a woman naturally how to push, because that's what you do to push a baby out. So it's a myth. Most women successfully push a baby out while on epidural. The only difference is they're much more relaxed until that point when they need to push. Whereas women who are experiencing the pain or who are finding it difficult to cope with that pain want to get it over with as fast as possible. They start pushing even when the cervix isn't fully dilated, and these can make cause other complications.
I do want to share a comment that a listener was very adamant that I must share, that taking the epidural was the best decision she made. And don't listen to anybody else who tries to tell you otherwise. What can happen if a woman tries to push when she's not dilated enough yet?
Well, you can push against, when you're trying to push against an unopened cervix, so there's a 10 centimeter head coming through maybe a 6-7 centimeter cervix. Well, it's not going to come, which means there's a sort of a minor obstruction. The cervix starts to get very swollen and liable to tear. And when you push, that's also when there's not a lot of oxygen going to the baby. So you actually start stressing the baby out by pushing too early. And in fact, what we want you to do is relax completely, let the baby descend naturally, and then only push. So that's a very short distance to push rather than all the way from the top of the vagina to the bottom of the vagina.
Now, how long should that last? Because you hear of women going through hours, and you hear of some women saying, oh, my baby came out really fast.
Well, a lot of it depends on how you feel, the size of the baby, the passage, obviously, position of the baby. So even how the baby is facing while in labor can make a difference in the duration of that pushing. The best position, obviously, is the baby looking backwards. That means looking towards your back passage and your spine. Mm. Because in that position, the bones of the baby's skull isn't just one piece like ours. They're made up of different pieces that have spaces in between. And what it happens is that these bones slide on top of each other to make the diameter smaller to come out. And that's the best position because it slides most easily. Mm-hmm. But when the baby is facing upwards, for example, that means facing towards your pubic bone or the bladder, then that diameter that's coming down the passage is the largest diameter. So you will probably deliver, but you'll end up pushing for a very long time and get exhausted.
Okay. Nothing we can do about that, right? Baby will come out the way it comes out.
Well, most times the baby will turn naturally. Some doctors, and this is what I normally do, if your woman is on a good epidural, I can actually put my hand in and turn the baby's head. But if she's not on an epidural, I'm not going to do anything like that.
I feel uncomfortable just listening to that. You know, I forgot to ask about water breaking. Is that necessarily the sign that a woman's labor has begun?
Not necessarily, because sometimes the water can even break preterm. And that doesn't mean it's time to deliver the baby. In fact, this is the time when you want to try and bring the baby to as close term as possible and maybe try and prevent infection. But if a woman's water breaks at term, so after 37 weeks, yes, it is one of the signs. In fact, if you wait 24 hours, 60 to 70% of women will start laboring naturally. And most of us will wait for that because you want it to be as natural as possible. But if nothing has happened after 24 hours of your water breaking, and if you wait 48 hours, 72 hours, ultimately everybody will go into labor. Unfortunately, after the 24-hour mark, it also increases the risk of infection to mum and baby unnecessarily. So this is also the point at which you'll be offered an induction to speed things up so that you don't put either mum or baby at risk.
Is it true that induced labour is more painful than natural labour?
Well, induced labour is a little bit more controlled because we know what we're putting into this woman's body, whether it's prostaglandin as a pessary to start off the cervical priming, or whether it's oxytocin. These are both natural substances that you will find in the body when a woman starts labour. But if it hasn't, then we introduce it. But the way in which it is introduced and the way it is controlled, it can try to get the contractions to as close to effective as possible. So you want to get it maybe 2 to 3 minutes apart, whereas your own contractions maybe 5 minutes apart, 10 minutes apart. And as long as it's doing something, it's okay to keep watching. So because we're getting the contractions stronger in a shorter time, yes, it will be more painful. And I would even go so far as to say maybe it's about 20% more than natural labor. But if you're on good pain relief, does it really matter 20% less or 20% more?
Mm. And we come back again to if you need pain relief, don't make the decision just based on some beliefs that people have told you, right? Think about what you're going through, what's best for you. This might be the time to bring up some other beliefs that people have about trying to induce labor, I suppose some remedies that you can do at home. So you've heard about things like eating spicy food, having sexual intercourse. So what works, what doesn't work?
Well, actually, none of these things work. Sex, the rationale for sex sort of bringing labor on earlier is from the fact that sperm has got a tiny little bit of prostaglandin, which is, like I said, what starts off labor naturally as well. But certainly on its own, it's not enough to spur things on. Eating spicy food, no, there's no food or drink that can get, because you talk about what raspberry leaf tea, none of these things really work. But if you did want to talk about something a doctor can do for you, ask them about something called membrane sweeping. Now, this is something that it's a vaginal examination. And if the cervix is already soft and even slightly open, introducing a finger into that cervix to sort of stretch it out a bit can irritate and cause a local inflammation. Now, what we've seen is that if you do a membrane sweep at the right time, so usually 39, 40 weeks, this will either get you to go into labor a few days earlier than you would have otherwise, or by the time you need an actual induction, your cervix is already primed and ready for it. Mm-hmm. So that works. But it's not very nice, unfortunately.
Mm. Is there anything in terms of some sort of traditional or home remedies that could actually be harmful, in fact?
Well, you probably heard of something called air soluso. So in the Malay community, you'll find that some women bring a little Tupperware of water, and it's supposed to be air soluso. There are two types of air soluso. Some is just plain water, and a holy man has said some prayers, and they use it probably placebo effect more than anything else. But there's another type of air soluso, which is a certain type of plant root, which is boiled, and this may actually contain substances that are harmful. Now, when I was still working in another hospital, we did a very local, small observational study to look at women who took air soluso. And what we found may not be evidence-based, but was that the contractions became very strong, but it didn't really dilate the cervix. So I would urge you not to take anything that we're not completely sure of. It's much better to get a medically induced induction rather than what you think is natural but may harm both you and your baby.
Mm. Can I ask now about birth options? Natural, vaginal, or C-section? Is there still this debate about which is better?
I think at the end of the day, it's about choice and what you would like for yourself. Yeah, some women will say, you know, I'm too posh to push, so I want a cesarean section.
But and is there anything wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong if that's what you want. And especially since if you're planning to have a very small family, I mean, we do cesarean sections every day. The risks are very small. But you can look at it this way. If you'd have a vaginal delivery, it's much better for mummy because it's natural. Even if you have some tears, it heals very quickly. You're up and about quicker. You're able to care for your baby more effectively when you're not in so much pain. A vaginal delivery is a stress for the baby, for any baby. A healthy, well-grown baby will cope with that stress without any problems. But a baby who's already having a little bit of an issue, who's a bit compromised at the end, is going to show that he protests. And so when the contractions start to get strong, you'll find that the heart rate is starting to drop. And then you end up having a cesarean section because of fetal distress, not because the mother cannot labor naturally. Now, a cesarean section, on the other hand, is better for the baby because there's no stress at all. You're just making a cut in the tummy, taking the baby out, but not so great for the mother because it is a surgery. It is through the abdomen. It is involving some anesthesia. And obviously, every subsequent pregnancy after that becomes slightly higher risk just because she's had one cesarean section. So every decision you make, it's weighing pros and cons. And what is best for you really depends on your circumstances and your discussion with your doctor.
Mm. If you've had a cesarean first round, can you have a natural delivery the next child?
Well, the first thing to ask is, what was the indication for the cesarean section? If the first cesarean section was because you were induced at 41 weeks and it didn't work and you had to have a cesarean section, it seems almost futile to try and do that again and fail again to end up with another cesarean section. In fact, it becomes more dangerous because now you're increasing the risk of that scar that is on the uterus from giving way and rupturing, because this is now a point of weakness. But having said that, if the cesarean section was due to something else, maybe not progressing because the baby was too big or the baby went into distress, then one cesarean section and one scar is, well, you can give the option to try a natural delivery the next time around. But if you've had two cesarean sections or more, then that risk of the scar giving way becomes unacceptable. Mm. But yes, it is possible to have a normal delivery, and lots of people have successful vaginal births after cesareans.
Mm. All right. We will continue this conversation after another break. I'm speaking to consultant obstetrician and gynecologist Dr. Shilpa Nambiar about labor and childbirth. Do send in your questions. She's here to answer them in our open clinic segment. Call 0377 332 900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Stay tuned. Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik, and my guest, consultant obstetrician and gynecologist, Dr. Shilpa Nambiar. It's our open clinic show. Send in your questions about labor and childbirth today. That's exactly what we're discussing. We've been through so much, covered, I guess, some biology. We've covered misconceptions. We've covered some beliefs and practices that some people may be confused about. So do call us 0377 332 900. You can WhatsApp 0187 89 8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. I have a question about home births, Dr. Shilpa. I've been hearing some people talking about going in that direction, and what are the dangers there, and what's your recommendation?
Well, that's a
big sigh there.
Well, I know women would like to deliver at home because they feel that that's where they're most comfortable. And although what we like to see happen is that most deliveries are uncomplicated and happy, it's not always like that. And in a majority of women, they're anything can happen. Labor is very unpredictable, even for the doctor and the patient, and a lot of things can go wrong. Now, we have progressed, or we've come a long way from a time when childbirth used to be an acceptable cause of death. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is because we now monitor women, we monitor babies, and we try and avoid the disasters from happening by sort of staying in the sidelines and preventing a catastrophe. When you're at home, there's no monitoring at all. There's no perception of how long labor should last. So a lot of things can go wrong, can go missed, and unfortunately, we've had a few maternal deaths from home births. In some other countries, home births are practiced, but only because there's always a trained birth attendant there, someone who's trained to monitor progress and deliver the baby. And it's a requirement to have a home birth. But in Malaysia, we don't have such kind of regulations. So as long as you cannot safely labor at home, I cannot recommend it.
Mm. Who is a trained birth attendant?
Midwives, nurses. And there's no impetus to force a woman to have a trained birth because it's not legislation in this country.
Mm. And you have some women thinking that a doula is good enough.
A doula is not a trained birth attendant. It's a birth partner whom some women feel is slightly better than their partner because he might panic and make her more anxious. But although some doulas can be very good and can be very supportive, there is a tendency for doulas to pressure women to go natural. And natural isn't always the best, because if something goes wrong, then it's very difficult to come back from that. I mean, if you start looking at complications of labor and delivery, there's 3-4 pages of them. And obviously, you don't want to scare every woman into what can possibly go wrong. In fact, you want it to go well. Mm-hmm. And the best way to do that is to let your doctor worry about the labor and only tell you if there's an issue that needs to be acted upon or intervened on. But otherwise, and you can only do that in a hospital or in a place where monitoring is possible.
Mm. I mean, it's 2022. You know, we are where we are because of advances in medicine. Then perhaps, you know, what women need to know in order to feel reassured is to understand. And we've talked so much about what she should expect in terms of labor, contractions, her options for pain management, the options for birthing the baby. But something I noticed I didn't even think to ask would be, what will it look like? In my case, it was a cesarean section. So what would it look like in the operating theatre? Because I was so ill-prepared when I was finally in there and completely terrified. Right. So what will it look like in whether it's the labor room or the operating theater? Who's going to be there? Can she have a partner there? You know, yeah.
Well, in fact, having a partner there is non-negotiable. You have to have your partner there. Now, we'll start with a normal delivery first. Mm. We try to encourage women who see us to have a look at the labor ward because at least then they familiarize themselves with where they're going to be. And also it gives them a chance to sort of personalize the room if they would like, you know, because you want to be relaxed. We go back a little bit to the pain because being the perception of pain is different depending on whether you're scared and anxious and afraid compared to someone who's relaxed and supported and happy. And you find that a woman who has her partner with her, a supportive partner, is less likely to ask for pain relief, is more likely to have a successful vaginal delivery and less likely to have tears. Now, this is evidence-based. So what's that telling you is that her experience of labor and how the labor progresses is so important depending on how well supported she is. So for me, you have to have your partner there. It's non-negotiable. So familiarizing your place is important, and I encourage women to go and have a look at it. Sometimes you may want to bring your own music to calm you down, maybe put on some headphones. You might want to bring in some aromatherapy diffuser so that it smells better. You might even want to bring in a birthing ball to sort of bounce up and down it if it makes you feel better. So you can try and personalize that space so that it feels a little bit more like home, maybe. But the operating theater, unfortunately, we can't do anything about that. It really needs to be cold. It really needs to be sterile. But we try to make it as pleasant as possible. We do encourage the husband, partner to come in because while at least we're doing the surgery, he can sit on one side and talk to her so that she can feel a little bit better. Mm-hmm. So yes, as long as it's an uncomplicated labor or whether it's cesarean section or vaginal delivery, we do encourage the partner to be there. Mm-hmm.
Who else would be there?
Well, if it were in the labor ward, usually the doctor who's delivering you and the midwife, usually one, sometimes two. It just depends on staffing, but you'll definitely have one person who's taking care of you. Depending on how long the labor process goes, they may change shifts, so you may change midwives. But your doctor is your doctor, especially if you're in private practice. If you were in a public hospital, then it just depends on where you are and how many people are there, depends on the staffing as well. If it's late at night, you just may have skeleton staff with a few midwives and maybe a junior doctor. If you were in a university hospital, then you might be asked if it's all right for the medical students to come and stand by or maybe even do some procedures. And it's up to you, obviously, to say yes or no. So it depends where you are. But if you were in an operating theatre, then you will have a few extra people. There will be a consultant anaesthetist because this is the person who's going to be giving you the anaesthetic as well as monitoring your during the surgery. There will be one or two assistants who are helping the doctor with the surgery. Mm. And that's it.
Mm. Now, very quickly, what happens after the baby is delivered? What should the mother expect in terms of the care of her baby? As well as, you know, does she get to sort of go back to the ward and recover? How long should that take, and et cetera?
SIM will divide it into a vaginal delivery or a cesarean section. Now, if as soon as the baby's been delivered, the first thing we do is put baby on mum, right on the mum's chest or on the skin. That skin-to-skin is quite important for that initial bonding. And we tend to try and delay clamping the cord. Also, maybe give the father a chance to cut the cord because it makes him, helps him to participate in the whole process. He's been feeling quite useless all this time.
Yeah, there's plenty of opportunities for him to participate after that.
And then we may just wipe the baby, but we don't wash the baby really. And as much as possible, we want to keep mum and baby together. Unless, of course, there are issues after delivery. If the baby's having some difficulty breathing or in distress, then the nurses or the doctor may take the baby away to help with that initial resuscitation.
Mm.
And similarly, in the operating theatre, it's usually a spinal anaesthetic which is given. So you will be awake through the whole procedure. You will hear your baby when it comes out. And we try as much as possible to have some kind of contact. It may not be possible to put the baby on the chest just because of logistics and how things are positioned. But you can try and at least kiss the baby and take some pictures just before he's taken away to the nursery until you're back in the ward.
Mm.
If everything is uncomplicated, you go back into the recovery area and the baby stays with you. And if you like, the baby will stay with you 24/7. And I'm sure that's what most women want in the beginning. In fact, they completely want to, they're completely besotted by the baby, that all they want to do is look at him or her,
mm-hmm.
and without caring for themselves. So they forget to sleep, they forget to brush their teeth or have anything to eat.
We have a question a listener wanted to ask. Is it true that the mother cannot shower for a month after delivery? So I guess we're going into that so-called confinement period.
Yes.
Right?
No, that is absolutely wrong. In fact, hygiene is a very important part of the postpartum period, especially here in Malaysia where it's very hot. So you find that your metabolism goes up after delivery. You're hot all the time and you're going to be constantly sweating. If you don't have a shower and clean yourself adequately, there is a much higher risk of developing infections anywhere, whether it's in the pelvis or even a breast infection when you're breastfeeding. So it is important to clean.
Mm. Any other confinement myths that you'd like to address? there must be so many you've come across.
Yes, cannot wash your hair. That's in certain communities.
Certain things you should eat and not eat, I think.
I think a lot of these confinement practices come from maybe countries that are colder, where you really do try and keep warmth. You know, you're supposed to wear mittens and booties and keep yourself bundled up. But in this hot climate, that just means you're setting yourself up for a lot of sweating. And if you're not showering and bacteria is not cleaned, you're going to get an infection.
Mm.
So do what's comfortable for you. Take 3 showers a day if you feel comfortable with that. And in fact, it's important, especially if you have a wound to take care of, because even bacteria that's on the skin can make its way in if you don't clean adequately.
Mm.
Foods, what's important is that you try and eat a good balanced diet, because in fact, during breastfeeding, you need a lot more calories than you did during the entire time you were pregnant. It takes a lot of calories and a lot of fluids to make milk. It's a very strenuous exercise on its own. So women usually find that they are extremely hungry and thirsty.
Mm.
And I say, listen to your body and eat and drink. Whatever it's saying, just follow and do it.
Mm.
Do certain foods make it easier to heal and not? Well, there's nothing really medically, but if you're taking a lot of proteins, drinking lots of fluids, that will help you anyway.
Mm. We have a really important question here from Balan. How about postpartum depression? Anything that we need to look out for, such as personal history?
That's a very good question. And personal history is very important as well, because obviously, if a woman is predisposed because she has a family history of mental illness or depression in the past, or she has had this tendency before, the postpartum period is a very vulnerable time. But even if you have no such personal history, that first week or 2 weeks at home can be incredibly challenging to any woman, especially if it's your first baby. For one thing, there's a lot of hormonal shifts. You're used to a lot of hormones coming from the placenta, making you feel very good. And there's this sudden drop in all of these hormones. And that withdrawal can make women very emotional. So I tell women, go home, be prepared to start crying for no reason. Completely normal. There's nothing wrong with you. And it's easy to feel helpless because you're not sure what your baby wants. And no one can tell you what to do. The baby doesn't come with an instruction manual. And every baby is different. So having to learn what your baby's cues are, what the cry means, what your baby's pattern of sleep and feeding is, that is effort. And it is hard. So it becomes a lot more difficult if you've also neglected yourself at the same time. Mm. You've forgotten to eat, you don't feel like showering or don't brush your teeth. Mm. So apart from feeling helpless, you're also feeling filthy and sad and tired because you've got no sleep. So it's important to support women during this time. Take the baby and say, please, go have a nap now. While baby's sleeping, you have a nap as well. Please have something to eat. Can you go brush your teeth? It's 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And, you know, just those very small things make you feel so much better.
What about some bigger things, though, that a woman might need where the basic self-care, even if she is doing all that, or perhaps she's just reached a point she can't even do all that. At what point should she or her family around her really say, look, we have to go beyond this and get you help?
Well, for most women, this blues in the first 1 or 2 weeks is just needs supportive therapy. And that's just support from the family. Support doesn't mean that you tell the woman what to do. And it can be very difficult because although your family are very well-meaning, there are a lot of different opinions on what is the right thing to do.
Absolutely.
I usually say, shut everybody out. The most important person, the people in this family unit, are you, your partner, and the baby. And you have to learn about each other on your own. And sometimes your instinct should supersede what your mother-in-law tells you, for example. So your husband's role is not just to give you ice cream when you want it. It is also to maybe shield you from all these unwanted opinions. But there are... That's not to say that I am diminishing the value of women who actually do have postpartum depression. So if these kind of feelings go on for longer than that, and they're starting to neglect self-care or worse, starting to have thoughts of either harming themselves or their baby, then definitely you need some professional help. And even that, most of the time, is just about talking, counseling. Very rarely does it actually need medication. Mm. But you need to take those next steps before determining what a woman really needs.
Mm. And a follow-up to the question about postpartum depression was, can it turn out to be permanent?
It can turn out to be the first time a woman experiences depression because maybe she already has an intrinsic predisposition to it. And she may first experience it during the postpartum period and continue to struggle with depression and depressive symptoms. So for these women, you'll find that these symptoms last a lot longer. They've needed some medication and they need to continue taking it even after the baby's grown. And especially if they're embarking on another pregnancy, you have to be slightly more careful. So yes, it doesn't mean that because she had postpartum depression, it becomes permanent. I'm just saying that a woman who is predisposed may have a first presentation just after delivery, and then it continues after that.
Mm. All the more important to identify it. And thank you to our listener for bringing it up, as well as to ensure that the mother gets support as well as the treatment that may be needed. This story doesn't end here, of course. It is just the beginning for the mother and her spouse. But what is your final message for today, Dr. Shilpa?
My final message for today is that, you know, this labor, pregnancy and labor is an experience in your life. It's a milestone in your life that you will never forget. So try to get as much information as possible from the right sources. Ask your doctor lots and lots of questions so that you can familiarize yourself with what's going to happen. And it's much better to start discussing things that can go wrong to know what can be done to correct it early, because then you have a more informed decision rather than having to make decisions in a very panicky state while you're in pain and you know you're really not in the right state to say yes or no to something or the other.
Mm. And I hope that we have cleared up some of your questions. Thank you so much, consultant obstetrician and gynecologist Dr. Shilpa Nambiar, on the show with me today. This has been Health and Living on BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.